Today on Straight Talk Africa, what's the local and international response to the devastating damage caused by the cyclone Idai and massive floods in Southern Africa? That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Sheikh Sali, and today we are talking about the impact and aftermath of Cyclone Idai. The death toll from Cyclone Idai has climbed to over 750 in the three Southern African countries hit by the powerful storm. International aid agencies are scrambling to reach survivors with needed relief and to stop a growing humanitarian crisis. My colleague Paul Ndiho has more on the story.
The United Nations and international aid agencies are rushing food, medicine, and other emergency relief supplies to survivors of Tropical Cyclone Idai that ripped through Southern Africa, killing hundreds while destroying buildings and farmland across Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi. In Mozambique, the death toll from Cyclone Idai that slammed the port city of Beira and the surrounding areas has reached nearly 450 and is still climbing. The number of people in makeshift camps has also risen from 18,000 to 128,000, according to the nation's Land and Environment Minister.
It has increased from 417 to 446 lives. We also have a number of people that were affected, which is 531,000. Obviously, these are preliminary numbers. As soon as we do our survey of the ground, we'll be able to give you updates on this.
The tropical storm made landfall in Beira on March 15th with high winds and lashing rain that lasted for more than 9 hours, leaving the low-lying city of 600,000 isolated. International aid organizations have stepped up their daily deliveries of aid on cargo planes from around the world. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says they are preparing to deploy three large field hospitals as early as next week. The United Nations Food Program is ramping up its airdrops to isolated pockets of people stranded by the floodwaters and delivered food parcels to displaced families sheltering in schools and other public buildings northwest of Beira. Cyclone Idai also lashed eastern Zimbabwe, killing more than 250 people, a toll that actually could be as much higher. Worst hit was Chimamanimani in Manicaland, an eastern province which borders Mozambique. UN agencies and the Red Cross have rushed emergency food and medicine by helicopter to the stricken countries. Some families are burying their dead in dump graves as injured survivors filled up the hospitals. One resident told VOA 26 people from the area had already been buried. Nisha Sitole says that he walked a long distance after his village had been cut off by rushing floodwaters.
There is no bridge. All bridges were swept away. Even the biggest bridge at Chad, that is Nyahode Bridge, was swept away again.
Meanwhile, in Malawi, 56 people have died and a large number of schools in the flooded affected areas of southern Malawi have been closed. Some are being used as evacuation centers. Children are studying outside under trees after the floods destroyed their classrooms.
Most of the learners, they are not coming to school because the rivers are flooded and they are unable to cross those rivers to come to school.
The extent of the current flooding in southern Malawi is overwhelming relief organizations, leaving many struggling to respond in hard-to-reach areas. Malawi officials say the situation is becoming unbearable given the unprecedented levels of destruction.
We need a lot of food. We don't know. Perhaps the lorries we see here, they are to be distributed to us. We don't know, because up now we haven't received any food at all.
Weather forecasters are expecting more rain to fall in the region, and cyclone-affected families can only hope for quicker intervention from the international aid community. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Our distinguished guest today, journalist Yannick Mashere in Maputo, the Mozambican capital, and journalist Sidney Saize in Mutare, Zimbabwe. And in New York, at the United Nations, we'll be joined by VOA's Margaret Beshear. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Ambassador Antonio Gumende, who is the permanent representative of Mozambique to the United Nations. And here in Washington, we'll be joined by my colleague, Zimbabwean reporter Blessing Zuru. I have to say blessings and, of course, the rest of the panelists that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
Very interesting. Let's go to the ground and see what is happening. Let's go first to Yannick in the Mozambican capital, Maputo. Good evening, Yannick.
Good evening, everyone. I'm right now getting the latest updates from the government. The government separated the updates into different types. One is damage, and the other one is the response that the government is giving. But one thing that was announced and is very important is that the government said that the works of search and rescue are close to its end. Going to the damages are about 158,583 families that are still in need of care, and this corresponds to 794,000 people, of which 6,000 are vulnerable. It's important to refer that many food crops have been destroyed. About 474,000 acres have been destroyed, totally destroyed. And there's a great need for food. And the government said that the medical assistance and as well the medicine assistance are being taken care of. It's everything is secure when it's related to medical assistance and as well as for medicine. The great need that the government has said today is that they need about 900,000 mosquito nets and 900,000 kits of cholera. Because yesterday there were registered 5 cases of cholera, and 5 people died from cholera. 5 people died from cholera, and they most fear that this can turn into an outbreak. And right now there are 2,000 people suffering for diarrhea, and the government suspects that it might be cholera, and the government is making every effort to contain the outbreak. That's the major concern. In terms of response, the operations of search and rescue are being prosecuted by aerial means, helicopters and planes, and the process is in its final stage. Many of the affected area have registered a reduction of the flood level, and many populations have been rescued are returning to their places of origins, and they are starting to rebuild. One thing is important because the dam of Kaora Basa is registering high levels of water. It is about 91% of its capacity.
I see.
Which will trigger the floodgate to be open, and this is a major concern. 91% of the dam has been reached so far, and the government is making every effort to avoid greater issues.
Thank you.
Many schools have been flooded, but most of students have managed to return to school. About 90,000 students have been able to return to schools, but many schools are still flooded right now. And the government has secured the scholar material for the students, like bags and exercise books, for free. They will not pay for anything. And I would like to refer that because of this situation, the government decided to postpone the electoral census to the 15th of April, because it was previously scheduled to the 1st of April, and because of this situation, the electoral census have been rescheduled to the 15th of April.
Thank you very much, Yannick, for your insight.
Thank you, and
good luck. And let's now go to the neighboring country of Zimbabwe, and we're joined by Sydney in Mutare, Manicaland. Good evening, Sydney.
Good evening, how are you?
Terrific. What is the mood like on the ground?
The mood on the ground is quite sad from the devastating effects of Cyclone Idai in Chimanimani, where a record 179 people have been officially confirmed as dead. So people are still in mourning, and out of the 179 that have been confirmed dead, we still have 102 burials and 186 people that were injured, and 12 are still to be identified.
How are the rescue efforts going on so far?
The rescue efforts are still ongoing despite the bad conditions and the bad roads and the damaged bridges. At least 11 bridges were damaged. That is hampering road networks in trying to rescue people. So the government with their partners are making use of helicopters in trying to airlift and to get to areas where it's difficult to go by road, and mostly uniformed forces, soldiers are being used in the rescue efforts. And I'm told that the Zimbabwean government has also engaged the South African government police service and trying to go around trying to rescue and identify bodies that are still buried.
What about reports, Sydney, that there were government officials who were using megaphones announcing to people that they should leave their homes without necessarily telling them where specifically they should go, and that in other situations they were not really even warned about what was actually coming?
Yes, that's true. People were not really told of what to do. They were only advised of that they should leave their homes and to move to higher ground. But unfortunately, those higher grounds were also affected, and also those that were downstream. and the government had not told their properly people where they should go, where they thought it could be safe for them not to be affected by Cyclone Idai.
There was a woman with a child reportedly in Chimanimani who was wondering when the next water would be available. Is that true?
That's really true. Most people are worried about where they can get clean water for drinking and for other uses. So they're only relying on aid that is coming from government partners that is being airlifted to the various collection centers in Chimanimani.
Do you get this?
So water is in short supply as well as food.
Do you get the sense that there is good or reasonable coordination between the government, NGOs, and international humanitarian organizations?
Can you repeat that question again?
Do you get the sense, or is there evidence on the ground that there is good coordination between the government, NGOs, and international coordinating humanitarian organizations which are trying to help people?
I think the coordination is trying to be patched up following a meeting held today at the Mutare government offices where representatives from the European Union and also the United Nations, where Timo Okloninen, the ambassador, head of delegation to the Republic of Zimbabwe, met with the provincial minister, Dr. Ellen Gwaradzimba, as well as Bishop Parajuli, the United Nations resident coordinator, who were saying that they were not happy about the bureaucracy in as far as the distribution of food aid to the victims of Cyclone Idai is concerned. And also Timo Okloninen hinted that they were unhappy as well with regards to the food aid that was being distributed along political lines, that ZANU-PF members were only the beneficiaries of the food aid. So I think there was some lack of coordination between the partners, NGOs, and the government. I think that from that meeting, they could be going on to be working together properly.
Thank you very, very much, Sydney, for your insight, and good luck.
You are welcome. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Now, let's go to the United Nations Secretariat in New York to our correspondent, Margaret Beshia. Good afternoon, Margaret.
How are you?
I am hugely terrific. What about you? It's a very long time since we last interacted on Straight Talk Africa.
Well, thanks for having me on. I'm sorry it's on a sad topic like this.
Unfortunately. But what is the situation like from your vantage point, especially when you talk about OCHA? OCHA, of course, being the important coordinating organization, really, for rescue missions and what have you.
Well, really, it's all hands on deck here at the United Nations, Shaka. Not just OCHA, but at least a half a dozen agencies, the World Health Program, the World Health Organization, the World Food Program, the UN Refugee Agency, the International Organization of Migration. Everybody is on the ground in the three countries trying to assist in the relief effort. Today, the UN Refugee Agency got their first plane load of aid into Maputo. They have another plane going into Zimbabwe this week and one scheduled to go into Malawi. They're bringing aid for 30,000 people. There are the World Health Organization is working on the cholera issue. They are setting up three cholera treatment centers. The World Food Program, their director, Mr. Beasley, has been on the ground in Mozambique for the last 2 days. They've ramped up their response, bringing in dozens of staffers to distribute high-energy biscuits and other items. When they can't get to people on the ground because of the floodwaters, they're doing airdrops and going in by helicopter and stuff to make sure that people get supplies in remote areas, because there's still areas of the cyclone that they haven't really gotten to be able to assess what the needs are yet.
To what extent do you get the sense that they were caught unaware, or at least they did have some kind of heads up? Because at least the United Nations happens to believe in the reality of climate change.
Right. Well, the UN had stocks pre-positioned in areas. I believe, in fact, one of the World Food Program's warehouses got damaged in the cyclone. So there were supplies in the area, but not necessarily everything was salvageable or usable after the storm. The Secretary General has said that this is an example of climate change and that, you know, these three countries are not responsible for the emissions. They're not big emitters of these greenhouse gases that cause the effects, but they are the ones suffering from it. And that's what we see in much of the world, that the big emitters it's the small emitters who are suffering, not the big emitters who are causing it.
Do you get the sense that people are going to understand that when we talk about climate change here, we're talking about something real, we're talking about a science here, and not fiction, or not really some kind of fantasy, or some kind of myth?
Sure. Well, you're preaching to the choir if you're telling that to the United Nations. They're the ones ringing the alarm bells about climate change. It's some of the member states that may not necessarily agree with the Secretary General's vision. But the UN has been working on this for years. Under the previous Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, climate change was his legacy. I mean, this was his legacy issue that he really worked on. And Antonio Guterres is carrying on that. So there's a lot of effort to mitigate it. There's going to be a big summit here in September. There's some meetings actually later this week on climate. So there's, you know, the UN is actively working on it on all fronts.
When you compare and contrast with Hurricane Katrina, which happened back in 2005 in the states of Florida, Louisiana, and parts of Texas, to what extent would you say the international community has responded promptly to what is happening in Southern Africa than, for example, how the United States responded to Hurricane Katrina?
Well, I can tell you what's happening now. I didn't cover Hurricane Katrina, but Hurricane Katrina happened in the most developed country in the world, perhaps, and there was still difficulty in getting a strong response mobilized quickly. So can you imagine what's happening in less developed countries of the world? But the governments are working hand in hand in the three countries with the United Nations and with partner agencies to help the people most affected by the storms. And, you know, the UN is on the ground and ramping up every day their response to this catastrophe. Shaka? I think we lost them, Chuck.
Thank you very, very much, Margaret, for your insight.
Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome. Let's come here, and of course, I have my colleague here, Blessing Zuru. Blessing, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am hugely terrific, except, of course, for
the tragedy, of
the
course.
Not particularly great things happening in Southern Africa, including your country.
Zimbabwe, yes.
What is it like? I'm sure you've been talking to some family members, friends, and other people. What is it like?
I think people were really not prepared. If you look at Zimbabwe, this has never happened before, such a catastrophe. And, of course, if you look at the three countries that were affected, Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe, one would say at least Mozambique, has experienced something like this before. And even in 2012, you know, they were working with the World Bank to make sure that Beira is not flooded. But unfortunately, this cyclone Category 4 was just too much and unbearable. And, it has affected many, many people. The UN, at one time, they said that it had affected about 1.7 million, now almost 3 million. But just in Zimbabwe alone, 40,000 households have been affected, which translates to about 250,000 people.
Now, talking about how this has never happened in Zimbabwe, but you also, of course, acknowledge the fact that it has happened in neighboring Mozambique, not once, but twice, as a matter of fact. We remember 2000 and 2007. To what extent did they really learn any lessons from what happened in neighboring Mozambique, so for example?
I think the problem that I'm seeing is that there is no leadership at all in Southern Africa when it comes to dealing with such disasters. Because, you know, the argument from developing countries is that they are not contributing much to this global warming. And they actually blame China, America, and other nations. But the problem is they are the ones who are also affected. And you heard, for example, this weekend, there's this disaster unfolding. You know what Southern African leaders were talking about in SADC? They were talking about the independence of the Sahrawi Republic from Morocco. Mm. They did not even discuss anything to do with this tropical cyclone.
Why? And
nobody really knows. You know, there was actually a summit in South Africa to discuss the independence of the Sahrawi Republic, not even the cyclone. So that shows you that there is also a lack of leadership in the region on how to manage such disasters. And there's not even any regional coordination. So this is why you have it happened on the 14th in Zimbabwe. Today, you have cadaver dogs coming from South Africa to try and assist, because South Africa was saying Zimbabwe had not called for assistance.
I'm afraid blessing time happens not to be your best ally. I have to go to New York and be joined with the Mozambican permanent representative to the UN, Ambassador Antonio Gumende. Good afternoon, Ambassador Gumende.
Good afternoon to you.
How are you, sir?
Very well, very well. How are you?
I am hugely terrific. And how is the plenipotential extraordinary ambassador?
Well, the plenipotentiary ambassador is busy as usual, but he's well. He's coping.
I gather that you attended some kind of function that was related to what we are talking about back in Southern Africa.
No, not me personally. Maybe some of my colleagues, but not me personally. I was in the South-South Cooperation Summit in Buenos Aires and returned Monday.
I see.
So I'm here in New York. I haven't been to Southern Africa. I would love to go to Southern Africa, but unfortunately not this time.
What is the situation like from your vantage point? How is the government, for example, in Maputo responding, and what about the international community?
Well, the government has responded with the swiftness that the situation deserved. As you probably know, we have a mechanism created in the country for disaster preparedness. So when the signals were sent that this was going to be a cyclone of a huge scale, all the mechanisms were put in place. I can tell you that in the immediate aftermath, the government actually moved to Beira, and they held their cabinet weekly meeting there in order to coordinate the response from the ground. So the government has responded in, as quickly as it could. We were swift to declare a national emergency situation to enable the government to mobilize resources to respond, be it in rescuing people who found themselves stranded because of the rising waters after the cyclone had passed. As you know, a vast area in the provinces of Zambezia, mostly Sofala, the northern part of Inyamban, southern part of Tet, and the province of Manica that borders Zimbabwe, which was in the trajectory, direct trajectory of the cyclone Idai, were the most affected. So the government was on the ground to try to coordinate the response.
Now, talking about how the government was on the ground, there are some critics who are saying that you were hit back in 2000 and 2007 but in their words, not mine, that you don't seem really to have learned any lessons from that particular catastrophe. Is that a fair criticism?
I think it's not a fair criticism, and I'll tell you why. I think for Mozambique, as far as Mozambique was concerned, when we had the 2000 floods in the southern part of the country, that changed the whole approach to disaster prevention and disaster management. I can give you an example that might not mean much to a different country, but for Mozambique, that was very meaningful. Before the floods of 2000, the mechanism of coordination of disaster management was a department of the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And the reason for that was that when it comes to coordinating international response to a disaster, natural disaster, the Minister of Foreign Affairs was the entity that dealt with foreign governments, so that was the mechanism to mobilize support. But after the 2000 floods, the government decided that, no, it looks like that the cyclones, floods, droughts were very recurring phenomenon. So this is something that we had to learn to manage and to live with. And as a result, the Department of for Natural Disaster Management was shifted to the Ministry for State Administration, which is an entity that deals with the territory in the country. As I say, this might not look like an important decision, but it was important in as far as taking into account the fact that the country had to accept that natural disasters were a fact of life, and they had to be incorporated in the planning process at every level, and that the only way to do that was to incorporate this entity within a ministry that dealt with internal issues. From a regional perspective, I can say that what people don't realize is that there's actually a mechanism that has been there for many, many years. SADC had established what it was called in the 90s, the early warning system for natural disaster, which served the entire sub-region. And as part of that early warning system, there's a mechanism called SARCOF. And SARCOF is the Southern Africa climate outlook forecast. That is done at the beginning or the onset of the rain, before the onset of the rainy season every year. And this is a mechanism that draws scenarios of possible rainfall pattern during a specific season. And this will pinpoint the probability of regions suffering from drought and regions that may suffer from flooding because of heavy rain. And on the basis of that, each national government then can develop a national contingency plan that enables it to cost and budget how much it will cost in the likelihood of that of such an event that had been planned for occurring, and that also enables governments to position the means that might be necessary for each situation. So there is a strong regional mechanism in place. But I'm sure if you have watched the images of what happens with this cyclone in particular, you realize that the scale of it, I think there's no preparedness that could prepare a country for such a devastating effect of having winds of up to 240 kilometers an hour and hitting a city like Beira. That's why if you look at the images, you can see that basically there's no building that was left with roofing. I have seen images of aircraft having been blown away by the sheer force of the winds, and you have seen the images of vast areas of the countryside completely flooded, and there was no place even to land a helicopter when the rescue operations began. You would have to do it by boat. So I mean, there is a level of preparedness, but nothing could have prepared us for for the scale of devastation that this particular cyclone has unleashed on the three countries that have been affected.
If you were to talk to us, Ambassador Gumede, from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your Mozambican heart and soul, do you think that there is something that the government could have done and should have done in order to be able to save more lives?
Well, the government did what it could. As I explained, we have an internal national early warning system, and the moment that the Met services began to signal that this phenomenon was likely to hit that particular region, the information was sent. But the speed of the cyclone itself and the scale of it made it impossible for us to go to do more than what the government has been able to do. And in this case, and we are talking about our particular country, Mozambique, but this could have been the case in any other country, because the scale was such that it was difficult to envisage any other mechanism that could have saved more life. But the government did what it could. You know, we communicated, we deployed the means that were necessary for the recovery process. But there were many aspects, many dimensions of the disaster itself that were beyond the control of the government.
You talked about the effectiveness of the early warning system. What about the long-term aspects of early warning systems? Do you think or do you feel that there are some of those long-term aspects that perhaps the government or the international community should have made people aware in order to protect themselves? I'm talking about, for example, the tools that one uses to build houses and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I think each natural disaster is part of new lessons to be learned, and obviously this is an aspect that has to be taken into account. But I can tell you that in the different interventions that the government has had over the years, one aspect that has always been present was to reduce the vulnerability, particularly of the most vulnerable people, by, for instance, encouraging them not to build along riverbanks, or, you know, in order to avoid situations where whenever we have floods, which are very frequent in Mozambique as well as droughts, they find themselves losing not only their crops but also all their belongings and the sources of their livelihoods. So that's a component of the disaster management strategy. And of course, in the case of this cyclone in particular, of course, there are aspects that we have to learn and incorporate perhaps in developing the norms and rules on how to build, how to build, what kind of materials used to build. But we have to also, you know, bear in mind that we are talking about populations that have already very limited means of survival. So it will take time, but I take your point that it is important that we look into that aspect as well, in order to mitigate and reduce the vulnerability once this kind of phenomenon happens again, which is likely to happen, because we have seen that the frequency and the intensity have become even shorter than it used to be in the past.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, we'll be right back with you, but for now, we have to go. A reminder that we appreciate all of our audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, on April 7th, the United Nations marks the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, one of the darkest chapters in modern African history. more than 800,000 people, mostly Tutsi, were systematically killed by a Hutu-majority government in 100 days. An in-depth discussion on what Rwanda and the world has learned from this tragedy on the next Straight Talk Africa.
And today we are discussing the impact and aftermath of Cyclone Idai and the rescue efforts that are underway. Our guest, Ambassador Antonio Gumede, plenipotentiary extraordinary and permanent representative of Mozambique to the United Nations, and Blessing Zuru, reporter for VOA's Zimbabwe service. In the show, we are joined by Yannick Machel in Mozambique, Sidney Saize in Zimbabwe, and VOA's Margaret Bashir at the United Nations. I have to say, Mr. Ambassador and Blessings, I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you so much.
I see. You're most welcome. Now, Blessings, what would you say really that is very, very urgently needed right now in order to make a difference on the ground?
I think, sadly, what happens after such disasters like this cyclone, people think that if the water begins to recede, there are no floods, it's not raining, all is well. But I think, like what Yannick said, I think there's another disaster that is looming, cholera, typhoid, waterborne diseases. So I think what is important is to rush water so that people don't drink water that is not safe. Unfortunately, this is what has been happening because aid has been slow in going to where it is needed. So medicines and water is very, very important at this juncture.
I was reading through the social media and I came across a lot of criticisms from contributors, essentially saying that we're looking at governments that are very, very insensitive to the needs of their people.
That's a
fair statement?
It is a fair statement. If you look at Zimbabwe, for example, you know, there's global warming. Everyone is talking about it. But in the country's budget, there was only $3 million US dollars for such disasters. And you can see that this is going to cost billions and billions of dollars to repair the roads, the bridges, to try and rebuild. But you still find that most African governments, the money goes towards defense and the president's office so that they can travel around the world, but not to where it is needed, like disasters, for example.
Fly first class.
Indeed.
Business class. Mm-hmm. Drive chauffeur-driven Mercedes-Benz limousines.
Yes, import all the latest cars from Europe and America, but not investing in their own people. And there's also a lot of corruption. So, you know, those are some of the problems that the continent faces and has to address.
What do you think is supposed to be the fundamental reason why someone should be in charge of a country, be ahead of a government? Isn't it perhaps, in fact, to provide security? And when we talk about security, what are we talking about here? Is it simply preventing enemies from coming into the republic?
I think, sadly, the problem is that, leaders forget that they voted in to save the people, not themselves. But in the end, you end up having such problems in that, the ambassador was, for example, saying that SADC was prepared. But I don't think it was the Southern African region. Even up to now, there is no meeting to deal with the crisis, you know, that is killing many people. And that is, like the ambassador correctly pointed out, is likely to occur. There's no emergency meeting to discuss such issues. So already you see that there are problems that needs to be addressed in terms of leadership.
But Blessings, what about some people who will say, wait a minute, you had Hurricane Katrina, for example, in the United States of America, a superpower, a country that has probably everything you can think about to be essentially in a position to protect and provide security to its citizens. And yet, in 2005, in August, that did not happen. You had an American president flying in Air Force One, overflying, in fact, New Orleans, where things were going so badly. And you had a situation that cost, essentially, $125 billion damage. And you had almost 2,000 people dead.
Of course, they say if you don't learn from history, you risk repeating it with all its imperfections. So I think Hurricane Katrina must have been a lesson for African nations. You know, what needs to be done is for them to pool resources together. You know how much SADC contributed to Zimbabwe?
No.
150,000.
You must be kidding.
The African Union, about 300,000 to all these three nations. This is a continental body. So they must prioritize such disasters because they will be coming and many people will be killed. So that only, so all the aid that is coming in is from the United Nations, is from the European Union, you know. And you even have helicopters from the European Union, not even from fellow African countries like Nigeria, for example. You know, mm-hmm. only South Africa is assisting. But you have, you know, countries that are rich, Nigeria and countries like that, that can assist, but no coordination.
I see. Well, good afternoon, Ambassador Gumede.
Yes, good afternoon.
I'm sorry that we are experiencing some apparent technical difficulties, and
okay.
I hope you'll find some space in your beautiful Mozambican heart. Forgive us for that.
Always, always, always.
Now, talk to me, Ambassador Gumede. What would you say really needs to be done and should be done, at least from your development partners, mm-hmm. your colleagues in the international community, to come in and help turn around the situation?
Well, I think the response has been coming at least from the immediate aftermath of the cyclone Idai. And as you probably know, as I mentioned, the UN responded immediately with the response of $20 million. Dollars for the three countries, of which 14 million were from Mozambique. The UN has just launched a $282 million short-term, 3 months appeal to enable the affected population, which at this stage stand at around 800,000, but this is very preliminary, to enable them to rebuild their life and especially their livelihoods, because one thing that has to be understood is that most of the people who are affected in the rural areas, they survive on agriculture. They are peasant farmers, so they need time to go back to the land and grow what enables them to subsist. So it is an early stage, but the real challenge will come when we have to mobilize resources for reconstruction, and I think that's where we would need perhaps the same level of understanding from our development partners that this is a disaster of a magnitude that the country cannot cope by itself. There's vast infrastructure that has been destroyed. Right now, we're talking about social infrastructure of about 3,000 school, 3,000 schools that have been affecting 90,000. So these are damages that will require a massive effort, and this is something that the country will need continue to need foreign assistance, and particularly to rebuild the infrastructure to have access. To not only to the rural areas, but to enable the rural populations as they rebuild their lives also perhaps to move their own goods to the markets and all that. So they reestablish the economic fabric, the social and the economic fabric of the affected region. So that's when we will expect, once the government is ready with all the assessment, the needs assessment that needs to be done over time with the assistance, obviously, of the UN and other international agencies, then we'll move to that stage where we may seek help for the reconstruction phase, as it happened in the year 2000. We had the immediate response, and then we had the kind of appeal that was launched in recent days, and then we had an international conference to mobilize resources for post-floods reconstruction in Rome. So this, I think this will be the standard pattern that will be followed, and we would like to appeal to our partners to continue to be with us as we recover from this natural disaster.
I see. I understand that we have to go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good afternoon, Tedla from New York.
Yes, good afternoon, Shaka. I mean, I watched this disaster unbelievably by ABC, and when I see those helicopters try to save life, it was heart-wrenching. But I don't blame basically the Mozambique government. This is a huge disaster, let alone Mozambique or the neighboring countries. Such is an unimaginable disaster. My worry is that even the people are not aware of this disaster. It has never happened like we see it in Asia, in America, where people are warned and they will go. Because if you don't, these things happen frequently. Even if they tell you move on, you don't move. This is human nature. So now is a learning process. Africans, we are now in this same cycle of typhoon. This should be an education for everybody. So the future warning has to be go through a school system, and then we should act. But blaming the government or blaming, I don't blame nobody here. This is a huge disaster, and if we can't have to help now to contribute money, we should be doing so. That is from our African heart, my friend.
Thank you very much, my friend Tedla. It's been a very, very long time since I last heard your beautiful voice. How do you respond to Tedla, Ambassador Gumede?
Well, I think his comment was along the lines of what I had said. I mean, the scale of the devastation in itself, it cannot be blamed on the government or its inability to respond, because the government responded, as I say, swiftly. But the devastation in itself was so massive that it was beyond the control of anybody. So, but I think, as he says, it's important for us to also bear in mind that the frequency of this kind of disaster with climate change is becoming more intense. So we have to really incorporate, as we are doing in Mozambique, disaster management and prevention and preparedness as part of our process of planning, development planning. It has to be mainstreamed. It's not something that it's something that any country can afford to regard as secondary.
What about civic education to sensitize people, to make people aware of these types of things?
No, this is an one of the tasks that has been entrusted on our disaster, National Disaster Management Institute, not only to sensitize people who are classified as living in vulnerable areas, but also in the sense of looking at diversification of their livelihoods. As I said, we are talking about cyclones, but it's not just cyclones that hit Mozambique with recurring frequency. We have droughts. Sometimes we can have floods in northern Mozambique and had droughts in southern Mozambique. It has happened in the past. We had that situation in 2015. So this is something that we are learning to live with, and we are encouraging the population to learn new methods of earning a living or producing food to respond to the to what is now a common reality.
What about the budget for the docket that has the responsibility for dealing with such disasters? Do you think that the budget is looking good, or does it perhaps need to be made a little bit more?
No, of course, resources are always, by nature, by definition, they are scarce resources. So it's very difficult for us to mobilize enough resources for the needs that we know we can quantify on a yearly basis in order to enable the institute to operate at optimal level. What we count on is the support of the development partners to complement the resource that the government itself puts into invest in this important institutions. As I told you, that every year we have we draw up a contingency plan based on the information that is collected from the regional processes of forecasting what the climate or weather will look like at the onset of the rainy season, and on the basis of that we can cost, and we know exactly how much we would need if a certain region would be hit by either drought or flood. But the challenge is always to mobilize enough resources and means in order to enable the institute to respond adequately. And on that, we have to rely on our development partners.
Ambassador Gumende, you know as well as I do that we're talking about perhaps the effects of climate change, which in fact can also even be seen by a blind person. But what about those doubting Thomases? And there are many, including, in fact, some here, just as much as at home. What kind of message do you have for those types of people, that we are looking at something that is real here? We're looking at a science, really, and that these are issues that must be tackled and dealt with, that we are not actually looking at a myth. This is not make-believe.
No, I mean, the evidence is there for them to persuade themselves, and it was not by accident that the world came together to adopt the Paris Climate Agreement, the entire world. It's because the entire world has recognized that climate is an issue for the survival of humanity. So they only have to join the already existing universal consensus, because there is a consensus on this matter. And if you need recurring evidence, they have to look no further than just looking at the devastating effect that this cyclone has had across three countries. And there's no guarantee that we a few months down the road we may not be talking about a drought somewhere else, or floods somewhere else. So I think the evidence is there, and there's no reason that some should continue to deny what is, as you correctly put it, it's an obvious reality.
I see. Well, unfortunately, that brings us to the end. And our guests today were Ambassador Antonio Gumende, VOA's Blessing Zulu, Yannick Michael, and Mozambique, and Sydney Saize in Zimbabwe, and VOA's Margaret Beshear at the United Nations Secretariat in New York. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Southern Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.